received his master's degree and received his master's degree in theology from Cambridge University in 1972. After graduating from Harvard Medical School in 1982, he completed a residency in internal medicine at Mass General Hospital. In 1985, Dr. O'Connell began full-time clinical work with homeless individuals as the founding physician of the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program, which now serves over 13,000 homeless persons each year in two hospital-based clinics, Boston Medical Center and MGH, and in more than 60 shelters and outreach sites in Boston. With his colleagues, Dr. O'Connell established the nation's first medical respite program for homeless persons in September of 1985, with 25 beds in the Lemuel Shattuck shelter. This innovative program now provides acute and subacute, pre- and post-operative, and palliative and end-of-life care in the freestanding 104-bed Barbara McGinnis House. Working with the MGH Laboratory of Computer Science, Dr. O'Connell designed and implemented the nation's first computerized medical record for a homeless program in 1995. From 1989 to 1996, Dr. O'Connell served as the National Program Director of the Homeless Families Program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Dr. O'Connell is the editor of The Healthcare of Homeless Persons, a manual of communicable diseases and common problems in shelters and on the streets. His articles have appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, Circulation, the American Journal of Public Health, the Journal of Clinical Ethics, and several other medical journals. Dr. O'Connell has been featured on ABC's Nightline and in the feature-length documentary, Give Me a Shot of Anything. He has received numerous awards, including the Albert Schweitzer Humanitarian Award in 2012 and the Trustees Medal at the Bicentennial Celebration of MGH in 2011. Dr. O'Connell has collaborated with the homeless programs in many cities in the USA and across the globe, including Los Angeles, London, and Sydney. Dr. O'Connell's book, Stories from the Shadows, Reflections of a Street Doctor, was published in 2015 in celebration of BHCHP's 30th anniversary. Dr. O'Connell is president of the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program and an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. So we welcome you to our program. We get to spend an hour with you and hear your stories. And then at 1 o'clock, we'll open up for discussion with you and Mary Rose. So glad to have you here.
Welcome. Oh, thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here. I squirm every time I hear that, but thank you for going through that. I appreciate the introduction. I often think when I'm listening to that, my mother, who died about 4 years ago, I don't know if you noticed, there was a 10-year gap between, school and between finishing school and getting to medical school. And she made me promise that I would never talk about those 10 years, but someday when we can all get together and be alive, I'll tell you about those years. They're much more interesting than the years I've had since. But is it okay if I share my screen? I have a few pictures to show, and I think I can do that without too much trouble. I mean, at least I hope I can do that without too much trouble.
Yeah,
things open. Let me just see here for a moment if I'm on the right one. I hope this is it. I just realized there's two things open. I hope I just hit the right thing and I don't. Let me make sure I have. I'm going to go for it. I'm not sure this is the right one, but let's do it. So sorry. Thank you for your patience on that. I hope, can everyone see this? Is it okay?
Yes.
Good. Yes.
I thought I'd take you back. The journey for me, by the way, is one of just serendipity and sheer good luck, or as some people would say, misplaced luck. But I, you know, when I was finishing residency back in 1985, I really wanted to, I was fascinated by oncology and I wanted to do end of life care. I wanted to do palliative care. And I was on my way to New York to do a fellowship at Sloan Kettering when the city of Boston got a grant to take care of homeless people. It was came from the Robert Johnson Foundation. And as you may remember, in the early 1980s is when we had the explosion of what I would call the modern problem of home, the modern wave of homelessness. And we were seeing in our emergency rooms across the country, lots of homeless people coming in. And the Robert Johnson Foundation was saying, why aren't we getting out to get care to them before they came to the emergency room? It sounds very familiar to what we're going through today. But they did a really interesting thing. They gave these grants to cities. So they were four-year grants. They were given to 19 cities around the country. You had to have 250,000 people or more to qualify. And the thing they did, Boston was one of the, turns out, just parenthetically, we were in the New England region. And believe it or not, there's only one city in New England that has 250,000 people or more, and that's Boston to this day. So we were in hot competition for the grant with ourselves. and won. But what happened is the foundation told the mayor, and these grants were given to mayors, that they had to get a coalition of stakeholders together to decide what how they wanted to be served. And this is a picture, a relatively early picture I have of our, what we call now our consumer advisory board. And it's people who are home, many of them are currently homeless or have experienced homelessness. But we were, the mayor had to sit with them and figure out how they wanted to be served. And they did some interesting things. I was not part of this. I'm still a resident, by the way, when they did that. But they decided they were sick of fragmented care. They said that every time they went to this, they got sick, they would see somebody different. Nobody followed them. They had no, at the time, they had no primary care doctors or people that would take care of them consistently. So they wanted, first and foremost, continuity of care. And second thing they did was say that they wanted us to stay very much a part of the hospitals because when they got sick, they would be in the hospital and they wanted to be sure somebody they knew was there to take care of them, but that we needed to go to wherever they were to bring the regular clinics. So that's how we started out with the hospital-based clinics, both at Boston, at the time it was Boston City Hospital and Mass General. And then from there, we had to venture out to the shelters and take care of people where they were, you know, because the struggle to survive on the streets and the shelters doesn't make it easy to make appointments. But then they did a kind of interesting thing. They also wanted, they wrote this thing up and they got it signed by Helen Dorr and both the city and the hospitals had to sign on. And they decided that this was going to be a program, if they were going to be part of it, it had to be based on justice and not charity. I didn't see this, by the way, until almost a year after I was working here. And by that, they meant that they were sick of being, and this is a perception of homeless people, okay? They were sick of being kind of what they called the guinea pigs. You know, the only people they ever saw were people like me coming to do something for 3 months or 6 months who just did that as a good work and then moved on to their career. So they wanted to make sure we set up an infrastructure that had provided continuity of care from street and shelter right through the hospital. And they would not let us use volunteers. And I had gotten every friend I could rally to become volunteers in this program. I had my friends who were going into cardiology and dermatology, and they were all going to help out. We were all going to do different things. But the homeless people, believe it or not, would not allow us. So for about 5 years, we could not use a volunteer. And to them, volunteers smacked of charity, and they didn't want charity. The other thing that they did, that which actually slayed me, because I was, you know, had been a student for 4 years in medical school and 3 years in the hospital. But they didn't want students because they felt that students were coming out to learn on them, you know, feel their heart, listen to their hearts, feel their stomachs, do the physical exam stuff. And then they went off and did their careers somewhere else. So they didn't want to be the guinea pigs anymore. Now, I tried to say, hey, listen, if you go to Mass General Hospital, there's always a student. You know, Henry Kissinger, when he came in, I had to do his primary exam before the cardiology people saw him. So that was just part of life in the hospital. And I didn't quite see it from the eyes of a homeless person. We also, and I won't bother, we also couldn't do any research on mental health services. There are long stories around that. But suffice it to say, what they were looking for and challenging us to do was to stop treating the care of people like them as something we did either as a volunteer thing or as something we did for a brief time in our lives and then moved on and did our career somewhere else. And so when I realized this, you know, when I took this job, I was my chief of medicine and a doctor named Tom Durant, who is a real mentor of mine, had gotten me to do this. And I said, I'll do it for a year. You know, this is going to be my year. They delayed my fellowship. So all of a sudden, I'm doing this job, trying to understand it and realizing that the people that I'm taking care of really resent the fact that I'm only going to be here for a year. And that really was a comeuppance for me. I had no clue about that. And I also wanted to point out that there are, you know, in the the way my career evolved in going from the hospital out to the shelters, it was all, I learned almost everything I know from four really remarkable, strong, independent women. One of whom is right here on the left, Barbara McGinnis. And she's the person, the nurse who was at Pine Street. She was actually, you know, quietly a third order Franciscan. And so part of like the Catholic worker movement and all that. You may all know that, but Barbara was fabulous. She knew every homeless person there. She was a nurse, did not want to be in charge of anybody, didn't want to supervise anybody. She just wanted to do her work. And she was the first person I really met at, when I got to Pine Street. And she was really the one who sort of pushed me in the right and wrong directions. And we named our program, our main building is the McGinnis House. It's named after Barbara. But she's sitting with Yoshiko Van, who's a nurse practitioner that was my partner. We were one of the deals with continuity is they asked us to always work in teams. So I never had my own panel of patients. I shared it with Yoshiko, a nurse practitioner, and Mark, who is a social worker, with the idea being that if any one of the three of us left, the homeless people we were taking care of still had the rest of the team that they knew. So there'd always be continuity. And Yoshiko was just fabulous to work with. But the first thing they did, I don't know if you've heard this, but Pine Street used to do this remarkable thing with the nurses. And this was a nurses clinic. I think it was the first one in the country. It was the only independently licensed nurses clinic in the country at the time. And I was invited to become the doctor down there. And I thought they were going to be thrilled because I'm coming out of the hospital, just finished residency, my first job as a doctor. And I walked into Pine Street and the nurses were, I have an older sister who's a nurse. So if any of you are nurses, you will understand what I'm saying. But I got the stern look of the nurses when I walked in. And they were pretty upset that we doctors had not taken very good care of homeless people. And we sort of ignored the nurses who had been doing it for a long time. So I was told I had an apprentice. This is Barbara told me I had an apprenticeship and I would be soaking feet for the next 2 months, that I had to put my stethoscope aside, all my other stuff aside. And mind you, I'm coming out of just finishing a 30-day rotation in charge of the ICU at Mass General, which is high tech, everything going on. And I'm there now being told I can't use any of those tools, soak feet. And what Barbara was trying to do, which I'm sure you all know too well, was get me to slow down, stop thinking like this is things are going to happen in the first minute or two. And I was trained in a world where, you know, you had 10 or 15 minutes to say hello to somebody, get their chief complaint, you know, do a quick exam, make a diagnosis, get them a treatment and move on to the next person. But as Barbara said, and the nurses, that never works with homeless people. You have to slow down, which is very hard to do when you're coming out of the rat race that I had been in. And the way they made me do it is by soaking feet. It's a great flipping of the power structure so that you're at the feet of the person you're serving. It also was very respectful of the personal space that homeless people really tend to protect. And I had never realized, but you know, when you're listening to people's heart and looking in their mouths, you're right in their space. And that did not work very much for homeless people. And the other thing is, these are people who've been walking around all day. So soaking feet is incredibly comfortable for them and comforting for them. So I was, I wasn't thrilled to be doing this, but I started to realize what the nurses were saying. This was a service you could do. You were far away from somebody's personal space and you could get to know them. I show this picture. It's the oldest one I have. Because this man who was a character, I had known him from the emergency room at Mass General from several multiple admissions. He never did anything we said. In fact, in the chart, we had said he was a treatment resistant, or he had paranoid schizophrenia and he was treatment resistant. So Barbara had me soak his feet. And after about a month of soaking his feet, he never said anything to me. He kept looking down at me with that kind of wry smile. And finally, he said, first thing he ever said to me, he said, "Hey, I thought you were supposed to be a doctor." And I said, you know, and probably the first person that actually acknowledged I was a doctor since I'd been soaking feet all the time. And I kind of lit up and said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, "Well, what the hell are you doing soaking feet?" And I did not know what to say to him other than, you know what? I do whatever the nurses tell me to do. And he laughed, first time I'd seen him laugh, because he was used to doing whatever the nurses was told him to do too. And so he decided I was a really smart man and worth talking to. And a week after that, he came in and he asked me if I could. He said, I can't sleep. Can you give me some medicine to help me sleep? And it was the first time he had ever asked for something for treatment. So, within about 2 months, he was on all the psych medications that we had dreamed of him being on. And he got in a group home where he stayed for about 20 years before he got lung cancer and died of lung cancer. But it was a lesson for me that, you know, sort of 2 months of soaking feet sort of erased 25 years of going in and out of the hospital resisting all treatment. And from that time on, started to catch on that the nurses really were onto something. The other thing that I would love to share with you, and I'm sorry I'm not there with you to see you as I'm doing this, but I also was trying to show the nurses that I was good because I was trying to earn my credibility. And this was a man who came in one night, and I had gotten to know him. His name is Emerico, and he was a character at Pine Street. He had the most unique, loud laugh you would ever want to see, but it made you laugh too. And when you walked in the lobby at Pine Street, you know, where there could be 700 or 800 people, his laugh would stand around above everyone else. Well, he came in one night to me and he said, Doc, you got to do something. And I said, my, what's going on, America? And he went, I can't swallow my vodka. Right. And I wasn't used to that as a chief complaint. but I said, well, tell me what's going on. And it turned out he had been unable to swallow food for about a month, but he could still get his vodka down. And that was what he needed, he said. But then his vodka wouldn't go down. It turns out, as you would imagine, he had a huge tumor right in the middle of his esophagus. So he could not get anything past that. And when I, you know, did all the workup, it was far beyond any treatment we could do at the time. And so I had to have the talk with him to say, you know, there's not much we can do, America. We could put, I don't know if you can see, there's a tube there that goes into his stomach so we could feed him past the obstruction. And then I remember spending the weekend writing and calling nursing homes to try to get him in a safe, good place so that he could die with some dignity. And I remember getting him into Marion Manor. It was in South Boston, not far from where he had grown up. And I was proudly took him there on Monday and drove him down there. We got him into the nursing home and he seemed pretty grateful. And, you know, I got him there and I said, Emerico, here, we probably got about a month to live, but let's take really good care of you. We're not going to desert you. And I was really proud of myself that, you know, I had finally done something good. And I went back to Pine Street about 3 days later, and I'm coming down the alleyway to go in, and I could hear his laugh right above everything else. And I don't know if you can appreciate, but that's a tube in his stomach with the thing there. And what he's doing is pouring the vodka right directly into his stomach. And I wanted to kill him, you know, like, Emerico, what are you doing? You know, this is not good. And he looked at me and then read me the riot act. And to this day, I will never forget this. He said that, look, Doc, he said, I appreciate all you've been doing for me. He said, but you put me in that nursing home where no one was talking to one another. Everyone was either watching TV or staring out the window. He said, and I couldn't stand it. He said, I've been at Pine Street Inn with all of my friends here for the last 30 years. I don't want to go there and die. I want to be here with my friends. And it kind of hit me between the eyes that I was not looking at things the way a person would look at. I was looking at it from what I thought would be the best things. And it was my real lesson in realizing that I don't push people to do what they don't want to do anymore. I look at that. But it was a real lesson from him, and I appreciate him from that. He, by the way, I should say, that's Sheila, one of the nurses at Pine Street. And he stayed at Pine Street for the rest of his life, which was about another 5 weeks. The nurses did the two feedings for him every day, several times a day, and he died where he wanted to be. And I would have once told you what a horrible thing to die in a shelter, but he died with his friends. Sorry, what did I do wrong here? So I'm doing something wrong here. Oh, and so the other thing, as an aside, the other thing they made us do back then was come up with what they called respite care. And I have no idea what respite care, but it was homeless people saying, look, when the hospitals, when you discharge us from the hospital, most people get to go home and they have their families and they have a visiting nurse and they have a bed they can stay in and a bathroom nearby. He said, but when we go out, we have the shelters or the streets, and the shelters at that time wouldn't let you stay in during the day. You had to leave from 7 a.m. till 4 p.m. And they were really angry that we, the healthcare system, did not really accommodate that gap in the system. So they wanted us to come up with respite care. And we opened a respite unit in the Shattuck shelter with Governor Dukakis's help back in 1985 and tried to learn what it meant. It meant people that just were too sick to be in the shelters and on the streets, but couldn't stay in the hospital anymore. So we evolved into what looks basically, this is now the Barbara McGinnis House on the top three floors. And it's 104 beds of respite care. We can do all sorts of things. I should have told you the building we're in now used to be the morgue for the city of Boston. So we had to preserve this room. If you ever come visit us, this is the old entrance to the city morgue. It was the morgue up until the year 2003, I think. And you can see the two sphinxes guarding the stairways going down into the morgue. By the way, the morgue, we had to dissemble the morgue itself where the things were. And there's a winged gold lame thing there with a hourglass in the middle. So when you walk down those stairs, there's a reminder that your time is limited. It's quite extraordinary. But anyway, that's the way it looked in 1931, and we had to restore it to that. That's part of our, but our respite program has turned out to be many things to different people. But one of the most important things it has been is a place where people can come and die. And we can do hospice and end of life care in a setting that is probably much more comfortable, if not more dignified, than a neurological cancer. He has several weeks to live at this point, but we had met him when he used to be, we had a clinic out at the Suffolk Downs racetrack for the people that worked in the back barns. He worked there all his life from the time he was 12 years old, never left the grounds of the racetrack until he got sick. And so he was dying with us. And Byron, his roommate, who was as different from him as anyone you can imagine, is in his 30s dying of lung cancer that had spread to his head and to his brain. And they became fast friends. They took care of one another. Byron basically took care of Tommy. But it was really, for our staff, it was quite... it was quite moving to watch the two of them handle their own deaths and to be privileged enough to be involved in that. It was quite amazing. And then I've learned a couple things I just wanted to share. And these are, pardon me, I'm just going to throw some stories at you that kind of become illustrative of things that I was never, ever aware of. But this is a woman who I used to see when we would on the Pine Street van. I'd ride on the van a couple nights a week, and we knew her downtown. She lived in a stoop down near South Station. And she used to surround herself with smelly things. She would buy milk and let it stay till it was totally rancid. She had old eggs and just awful smelling things. And we just thought it was disgusting, but I slowly learned from her that she was just trying to protect herself. That's how she kept people from coming near her. And she was a heavy drinker and not interested in stopping, and went on to get cirrhosis from her drinking. And so now, as she got sober after cirrhosis, she wanted to have a liver transplant, but couldn't have one because she was homeless. And most homeless people don't qualify for these because you need to show stability. And they call it residential stability in that. So we agreed to bring it to our respite program. And she stayed there for 6 months so we could prove to the surgeons and to her, I guess, that she could be sober, and we would send documented for her. And so she was now getting to the top of the list after 6 months. And I was coming into McGinnis House one Sunday morning, and she asked me if I would take her picture. And mind you, this is a woman who I'd never seen in anything but rags and soiled clothing. And she got this linen dress from somewhere, I don't know where it was, put her hair up in a bun, has lipstick on, has her fingernails painted, nice shoes. And she even went outside and got some flowers to put in the styrofoam coffee cup on her bedside table. So I took that picture. I only had a throwaway camera, and I took it. And at the time, I didn't take many pictures because I thought it was kind of voyeuristic to be taking pictures of homeless people. But I asked her, I figured this, she's worried about dying. She's going to have a liver transplant. She must be worried about dying. So I sat with her as I brought the picture back on that Sunday afternoon. I put it in a little frame and I said, hey, do you want to talk about what's going on? Are you worried about dying? And I was doing my best end of life addressing stuff. And she looked at me and it kind of laughed a little bit. And she said, are you kidding me, Doc? I've been out on the streets for 30 years. She said, I face death every single night I'm out there. And she said, and many nights I would welcome death to come. She says, I'm not afraid of death in any way. But she said, this is what kind of caught me totally off guard. She said, I have two daughters. Last time I saw them, one was 3 and the other was 5 years old. And that's 27 years ago. She said, I have no idea where they are, but I'm hoping that someday they're going to want to see who their birth mom was. And I want to have a picture of me looking like someone they could be proud of. So this was all about posterity. It's all about making sure if these two children ever went looking for their mother, they would see somebody they could really be proud of. Took my breath away. And I started to realize that, there's homeless people in our country in general, totally impoverished. They have almost nothing. I've worked a little bit in Haiti and I've seen poverty, which is even way worse than that. But when I was in Haiti seeing people, it was not a lonely poverty. They were, when people came into the hospital, they came with their families, the kids would be running around. It was kind of you were still part of a community, impoverished as you were. But with urban homeless people, my experience has been they are utterly alone. They have no one. And when they are suffering like this and have nothing, they have to do it alone. Most of them have burned bridges with their families or don't have families anymore, or, whatever the circumstances of their life have kept them lonely. So I thought about this. And since I had never taken pictures before, I came back a couple days later. And there were 22 people at our McGinnis house who asked to have their portraits taken. Okay. And completely blew me away. And now if you come to our McGinnis house, we have pictures of people up all around, because as I think we realize now that where I thought people would never want to have a picture of, many of them want to have a picture of themselves as human beings and as dignified that can be up and cherished. She changed my whole thinking about all that. And I did mention, we first met her when we were riding on the Pine Street van. And if you don't know about Pine Street Inn, with this van, it goes out every single night from 9 at night till 5 in the morning. There's actually two of them now, funded by the Department of Public Health, the State Department of Public Health. And it's miraculous. It brings soup, sandwiches, blankets, whatever you need to people out on the streets every night. The workers on there, and I don't think I have a picture of them, are not there, are my heroes in the system. They are the ones who, if I'm stuck, would set up a healthcare system for homeless people. I'd start with them. Most of them have been homeless themselves. Many are in recovery. The thing that I notice most about them is that they never, ever judge anyone. But anyway, so we've started, one of the things we learned, we had all these clinics in the shelters and at the hospital. But when we looked at who was dying most frequently, it was the people staying out on the streets, not even coming in to where we had where we thought our accessible clinics. So we've evolved. This is just a little aside. One part of our program is a street team going out to take care of people. That's where I have spent most of my clinical life these last 25 years. And this is Dave, one of the doctors on our team, seeing this woman who is in her early 80s, and she has terrible heart failure, but frightened to death of hospitals, won't go to see the doctors. But she was perfectly happy to let us talk to her and do all our stuff at South Station where they're sitting, including change her medication. We could weigh her there. We could take her blood pressure. You can listen to her heart and lungs. And so we learned, as much as we would never have said this to our supervisors at medical school, that we could take care of her heart failure pretty well as long as she was willing to let us do it there. If we've insisted on her coming to the hospital, we would have failed totally. So she taught us another lesson. And the other thing that we do when we go out, we've realized that when you go to see people out in the street, most of them have this awful burden of co-occurring medical problems, psychiatric problems, and usually substance use problems. And so when you go out as a team, we've realized it's always nice to have, the psychiatrist with the medical doctor, with the nurses, so you can work together. And so I love this picture because it's our social worker, Becky on the left, Katie, the second from the left is our psychiatrist. She finished her residency at Mass General a couple of years ago and has been with us now for 2 years. And there's a patient who lives there downtown just under an awning. And then Katie is our nurse practitioner. And it's just a delight trying to take care of people when you're all together rather than have to refer people to other systems. So it's been a real revelation for us. The other thing we learned is we've gotten to know people on the street, and this has been particularly relevant during COVID, is that once people kind of know you, just as Barbara and the nurses said in the beginning, they're much more likely to say yes to or trust you and say yes to what's going on. So we've learned during flu shot season, we can get almost everybody in the street a flu shot. And now even with COVID vaccines, by doing the COVID vaccines with the people that know them best, our nurses and our doctors, about 80% of the homeless people in Boston are now vaccinated, much better than most states, if you think about it. But I can tell you it's primarily because it's being done by nurses and nurse practitioners and PAs and doctors who they've known for a long time. It's not somebody new coming in and say, take this shot. There's a story behind this picture, but I'll spare you that. The other thing I'd share with you is that we learned as much as we can do out on the street and take care of people on the street, their burden of illness is so high, you can't really do it without the support of the hospitals. And many of you may know Partners in Health, because you know Paul Farmer well, but they learned that they can do things in the rural communities of Africa really well. But without a hospital, you can't really improve your stuff well. So they've learned the same lesson, or maybe we have learned the same lesson they have, is that having a hospital base where you've got specialty care and imaging and things like that is a critical complement to what you do out in the streets. So we have a clinic every day at Mass General, every Monday through Friday, but a Thursday clinic is dedicated to homeless people. And it's one of our real joys. And the hospital gives us coffee and muffins and stuff like that, so we can offer people a food, because they're coming right up the street. They can't get showered or cleaned up or anything. And we try to just make it as comfortable as possible. We have meal vouchers so they can go get a meal at the thing. I don't know if you can see here. It was after I took this picture, a medical student was pointing to me that somebody's sleeping under the table here. So it's a really, it's an intriguing waiting room full of all sorts of stuff. And we only have two little rooms, but this is our psychiatrist, Jim Bonner. And just like he does out in the streets when he sits at a McDonald's, he's just sitting in the cafeteria. And that's where he's learned that so many of the people are just frightened by anything that says psychiatry or mental health. So sitting at a table at the cafeteria and talking about stuff is really a much more preferable thing for folks. So he's been able to get to people who for years have been resistant to most psychiatric care. It's also a time at the clinic on Thursdays where we can sort of have students and, you know, this is a mix of students and patients and doctors who it's turned out to be a really fun community activity, especially during the winter when it's cold outside. So you can imagine people coming in. But now in shifting, and I should check my time because I'm so sorry, I have notes. So we're okay on time for a minute. So I just want to, this is a picture that haunts me. Okay. It's a picture I promised. It was taken by a homeless woman who lives under the Longfellow Bridge, lived for years. She's now found housing. And she took this picture with a throwaway camera of her group of friends. This was her community of street folks. And there is, I don't know if you can see this when I do it, but there is one woman in this picture and she's hiding right here. And then the others, I think it's 11 men are there, and they're sitting there. She took it. They're her friends. And I didn't, she took it in the year 2000, right at the turn of the century. And I didn't see this picture until she was sick and going in for an operation. She asked me to hold her stuff one day, 5 years later. And so I'm looking at her stuff and I saw this picture and I went, wow, I knew everybody in that picture because they were all folks we had known on the streets well. And she said, oh yeah, they're all my friends. And as I was looking at it, 5 years after the picture was taken, I realized a few things. One is, these are people we know well, and they all have insurance. They all have Medicaid, because this was Massachusetts, and beginning with Romney Care, you know, homeless people are among the first to be able to be eligible for Medicaid and Mass Health. The second thing is that their average age is in the mid 30s. Okay. And the third and probably most condemning thing from my own perspective is that they're sitting in a little park on the grounds of Mass General Hospital. So they're very close to what I would argue is a pretty good hospital. The emergency room might be 100 yards down this, not even 100 yards down the street. But when I looked at this picture 5 years after it was taken, there were two of those people still alive, just two. And when I started stepping back, you know, they look robust. They look, you know, they should be working. They look really tough. But in fact, we've learned that people living on the streets of Boston have a mortality rate that is 3 times that of somebody living in the shelter and 12 times that of someone the same age living in Boston. So living on the streets is particularly deadly, even though you may not see that when you walk by someone. And I'll show you just to let you know. So I said there were two people alive, and now as of today, there's none of them alive. And this is one of the men who's in that picture. And he's somebody we got to know really well. He's delightful, but his name was Mark. He was from the Mi'kmaq Indian tribe, and his family used to go up for the powwows up in northern Canada. And he was alive until he got pancreatic cancer last year. And we actually were able to get him housed. He did really well in housing, would struggle on and off, but did well on housing. And then just about a year ago, got pancreatic cancer. Long story, he ended up dying in Mass General Hospital. And he had we couldn't find any of his family members. They were all in northern Canada somewhere, no one that he had been in touch with. And there is an issue we always have with what do you do when someone dies and there's no one there, no one to claim the body, no one to do that. And there's a few places. One is the Lazarus program at the Shrine, St. Anthony's Shrine downtown, where they have, with some limited ability, they can do a service and find a burial ground for people. And they did this for Mark. And we went to the service, and check this. I don't know if you are into this or not, but this was the funeral service for Mark. There might've been six people in the church, but I don't know if you can see who's playing the cello. This is Yo-Yo Ma. And for those of you who know music, this is about as dignified as it gets. And it turns out Yo-Yo, this is an aside, does this all the time, but he will never take any publicity. He just does it quietly. He shows up and he'll play for people who have no one else. He goes and plays at shelters wherever he goes around the world. He will, on the morning of a concert or the afternoon of a concert, go to a shelter and play. Remarkable human being. And I blew it. And I did not, by the way, did not know he was going to be there for this funeral. He just happened to be there and played. When we look at the cause of death, this is the only slide I'm going to show you that looks like it's from a doctor or something like that. But I just want to point out to you that the primary cause of the most common cause of death among this population is cancer. It's not what you might have thought it would be. It's not like, you know, hypothermia or hyperthermia or assault, but cancer. And then you see other medical things for now. They're all in the setting of someone who's also struggling with their schizophrenia or their bipolar illness and maybe an addiction or addiction to some drug or alcohol. But it's the medical stuff that really combines with everything else that really is tricky. And, you know, these are just to show you how trying it can be. These are three men we have just known for years, and they were delightful. They're friends. They lived on down near the aquarium for years. And, you know, and Jose, and the reason I show this now, this is Jose, who he got housed, and he died 2 days ago of head and neck cancer. He was at the hospital. Daryl, who is his other very friend, was stabbed to death about 2 years ago on North Station. And this is Tony, who is actually somebody we got to know really well, but he was a gypsy. He was born to a gypsy family, and he needed a birth certificate, but it turns out he was born somewhere and where they were traveling around, there was no birth certificate. So we had to spend 3 years getting him any kind of benefits because he had no documentation of being born. But anyway, all three of them are dead now as part, you know, in that same thing. It's kind of really tricky. And one story to share with you that just has blown me away, and this is another, I picked some stories, by the way, of people who just have recently died. But this is Katie with her boyfriend, Bo. She's 17, almost 18 in this picture, and she's pregnant for the first time in her life. And she was living in a tunnel. I don't know if you know that under Copley Square, as you go, there's a series of tunnels where many people live. One is where it goes down into the Mass Pike, and then there's one for Amtrak tunnel, and then there's one for the MBTA tunnel. So there's three layers of tunnels, very complicated down there. But they lived down there, they struggled with cocaine, and we would go down and we were trying desperately to get Katie, as she was 6 months pregnant, to try to come in, mostly for the protection of the baby. And she finally agreed, as long as we would admit her boyfriend, to come to our McGinnis house. So this is the first day they got to McGinnis house. And I don't know if I have a picture of where they lived, but this isn't moving. I don't know what's going on here. Let me see if I can make my, oh, what's going on? I'm having trouble here. I'm so sorry. This is where they lived. If you walk down the, might recognize this. You walk down there, they lived down underneath in there. And on this, it's a very, it was so dark down there. This is an artificial light, but down in these platforms, way down in the tunnels. But anyway, they came in. Katie did really well. She spent the next 3 months at McGinnis House, did really well, no cocaine, did her prenatal care. And she delivered a baby on a Thursday night, right across the street. We're right across from Boston Medical Center, delivered there. And she called me the next morning and said, would I come over there? Because her mother and her grandmother were there and she wanted a picture of her family. And so I went over and I was kind of like blown away. She looks, you know, radiant and the baby's beautiful and healthy. But what was most striking for me was when her mother was on the left. And when I came into the room, her mother came over and gave me a big hug because I used to take care of her mother when she lived on the streets of South Boston in the early 1990s. or mid-1990s. And then her grandmother came over with and said, "You won't remember me because I've dyed my hair blonde, but I used to take care of her." She lived on the streets of the North End back in the late 1980s. So I was stunned looking at this. And this is four generations of homeless women. Okay, and you sort of get the picture of how structurally there's something very wrong in our society, that these are all women that needed help, never got it, and then ended up, each of them lost their daughters. So the grandmother lost the mother, and the mother lost Katie, and Katie is about to lose her daughter. So just a really remarkable story. Katie's story got a little bit more complicated, though, which is why. So this is Katie with Beau, and that was the family picture they wanted with the baby. And I would guess maybe a couple of hours after I took that picture, they gave the baby over to the same thing and said, "We can't handle this." And they went back to the tunnel and started using cocaine again. And about 6 weeks after that, Beau, who was asked, stemming for money, which is the word we use is stemming, asking for money outside of the 7-Eleven on Boylston Street, had an argument with somebody coming out and was stabbed to death. So Katie's lost her baby. Beau gets stabbed to death, and she's back in the tunnel all by herself. And you can imagine what drama went on for that. And then to make it even more complicated, Katie overdosed and died about 3 weeks ago at Copley Square. And in the interim, okay, now this is a frame shift of 10 years. In the 10 years since this picture was taken, Katie went through all sorts of soul searching, and she decided to transition to a man. So she transitioned, but struggled with everything, kept sober for a while, but then couldn't handle it, went down and overdosed. So when you think of a complex stories, this is, this tugs at everything. I've talked to all my friends about, how do you handle this? What's the best way to process this? What could we have done to really help Katie with what was going on? So if to make a long story short, she's not even 30 years old and is now dead from an overdose after going through all of this. I apologize, for some reason I can't get this to advance sometimes, and then it advances too many. Ooh, yep, something's going on here. sorry. So let me move to a better thing. Now, one of the things we've learned is that when you're out in the streets, you desperately want to get some safe housing for people. And I used to think that was the solution. And I would put up front now, housing is really great. We can't solve anything without housing. But you know what? Housing doesn't solve all the problems. It just gives you a platform now to continue to work on all of the things that people have been struggling with that had them end up on the streets in the first place. This is Jill, who's our physician assistant, was for 10 years. She's now finished her doctorate at the School of Public Health at Harvard and is doing research. But she's with one of our very favorite people, who's a man who only called himself Judge, the Judge. And he always wore a three-piece suit with a camel hair coat and that fedora or whatever he's wearing. And he hung out at the Commons, and he had a terrible problem with alcohol. But he would go to the State House and spend most of his days in the library at the State House. He would be out. Or then we would see him on the van at nighttime. He had been drinking, and it seemed down on the sidewalk, his head in the gutter, and his tie would be askew. And I'd wake him up and say, "Judge, can we help you out?" And he would go right into his, "Oh, good evening, Dr. O'Connell," and he'd start this whole judge thing. And I would talk to him about all sorts of things. He knew everything about Roe v. Wade. He knew, he just was really educated. And for the longest time, we didn't know whether he had been a judge or not. We just didn't know. But he was one of the very first people to get housed during the low threshold housing effort that began in the early 2000s. And he was went into housing still wearing a three-piece suit. He has an immaculately appointed studio apartment, as you can see here, with his globe, his bed, and the quilt on the bed. And he also has, remember, he still is a judge. So he has, in the middle of the room, this table. He calls the whole place his chambers. And this is his table with, spewed all over that, are legal documents, including the most recent encyclical from the Pope. And he considered himself a canonical lawyer as well. What was fascinating to me was he was doing, he moved into housing and it was effortless in a way, except once he got into housing, he kept the temperature up at about 95 degrees. And it used to be awful going in there. But I don't know if you can notice, there are two candles there. When the, in the heat, they've all withered and they're all falling over, if you can see that. So there's just a little reminder to me of how hot it was in there. And then he had his shoes, which he shined every day, kept in these wooden shoe trees. And I kept thinking, this is a man who lived on the streets for 25 years. You know, he's really pretty astute at doing all this. And then he asked me to take this portrait of him. And this was, by the way, the lighting on this was a mistake, but it came out sort of like, you know, it was the right thing to do, but I did not try to do that. And you can see his globe in the background. And he felt like most judges, he should have his portrait up. And so we took this and put it up. What you wouldn't know from now, by this time now, this is about 10 years after he was into housing. He's lost a lot of weight. And he has terrible head and neck cancer, esophageal, not esophageal, but pharyngeal cancer. And right now he has a trach under that tie. So he's actually breathing from his trach under the tie. And like so many of our other folks, when they got in, then it, we start to be able to take care of some of his medical problems. But you begin to uncover the real problem. So he died a few weeks after this. I was actually with him. We had to get him to a nursing home because he couldn't really breathe or take care of himself. And I remember holding onto his hand when he was dying, and hoping he would tell me something about, you know, judge, because I didn't know his real name. I just said, are you really a judge? And he, to the bitter end, hung on to being a judge. And I have a friend who's a federal judge, and I talked to him about this, and he commented on something that I've been dwelling on a little bit, that something awful happened to this man somewhere along the line, and he adopted the persona of being a judge, but he adopted it fully. You know, it became his fixed delusion. And as the judge pointed out to me, my friend, he said, that was probably the way he could continue to do really good things in the world. He was always trying to help. He was always trying to, you know, do good things. And he pointed out to me that if you've ever read Don Quixote, so Don Quixote, remember he went tilting at windmills and he was a poor peasant, but he became a knight errant and his delusions was that. And about somewhere near the end of the book, his friends gather him up and they say, look, you are not a knight errant. You are just a poor delusioned old man. And Don Quixote became depressed and died of his depression after that. So our judge was saying, maybe sometimes you have to let people have their delusions because that's how they're how they're coping with their lives. I don't know what the right answer to that is, but I, to this day, have no idea who the judge really was. And one of the ways we've learned to cope with the frequency of death, this is a picture in that same park where that picture was of everybody dying, but it was one of our, it was a day, there were two things going. It was a memorial for several people who died, but the young woman and the blonde woman in the very beginning is a student, undergrad, who was about to go to medical school, and she had been working with us for about a year. And this was this collection of homeless people and our staff and the police and everybody just out at that park, which we call Mousy Park, just to celebrate what an impact she had had on all of us. And I realized one of the joys of what we do, despite the fact that it's so deadly in many ways, one of the joys is that there is a real community feel to it, that we are all in this together. And so two Mondays ago, we had another memorial service at this park, and there's always flowers that we put around it. I think you might have it here. It's here. This is the service relatively recently. And, you know, there are volunteers there, homeless people, our staff, the police. And you get in, this is at Mass General right at that park. And it just makes us feel that we are so blessed to be working in a community setting as opposed to off on our own. Anyway, I'll just leave that as a little aside. Now, I think I'm going to probably stop there. I have other things to say. Well, maybe I can finish. Let me finish really quickly because I want to make sure we do talking rather than not. So there's another example of I can't move this. Well, so I thought I'd tell you, you know, you all are aware of there's a problem with Mass and Cass right now. The corner of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass was has become the epicenter of sort of a tent city of homeless people, lots of drug overdoses, just lots and lots of issues going on, which are unlike anything we've ever experienced in Boston, certainly not in my 35 or 36 years. So one of the things that caused it was the loss of Long Island Shelter. And I think you all probably know this, but this is Long Island. This is a map of Boston, which shows you the shelters and the yellow triangles are the adult shelters, the red ones are the family shelters. But there's this very interesting shelter out here, which I used to love. And you, to get there, you would come to Boston Medical Center, get on a bus, and would go down the expressway, off at Neponset Circle, then through Squantum and across the bridges to Long Island. And in 2014, on October 8th of 2014, the bridge to Long Island became impassable. And everybody who lived on the island had to be evacuated, which turned out to be 900 homeless people. But let me show you what the island looked like. This was the building, the original shelter building, which is about 450 people. And it's on this island. You can see, looking at downtown, it's quite beautiful. And from the back of the shelter, this is what it looked like. So it was quite spectacular. And it was land that is owned. It's an island owned by the city of Boston. And it was the site of the oldest chronic care hospital in the country. And many of the buildings that had grown up around there were empty and could be simply renovated and made into shelter. So what happened in 1984, when Pine Street was completely bursting at the seams, I think they had up to 800 people staying in that building. They had petitioned the city to come up with a shelter, and they couldn't find Mayor Flynn couldn't find a community that was going to be willing to accept a shelter. So he decided to use the island. And I can remember when I first started, and I did two nights a week on the clinic out on the island. I can remember thinking how cruel a city is that they would put homeless people on a bus and ship them out of sight to an island. I had visions of Molokai or something like that. It was real, just exiling people. Until I went out there and realized that many homeless people would thrilled to get on a bus. It was a choice, by the way. You didn't have to come out. You could go to Pine Street, but to come out and then be in this environment. And it was really nice for them. And then as I worked out there more and more, I realized that, and this was early in the AIDS epidemic, that because there was no community pressure, you didn't need a community agreement to open a new building or do a new program. So these incredibly creative programs popped up on Long Island. As long as you had the money and the idea, you could do it because you didn't have to do any of the long processing. So when the island closed in 2014, some of the most creative programs had to close down immediately, and they were not citable in a regular NATO neighborhood. For example, 70% of all the women's recovery beds were located on the island. So when that bridge closed, we lost all of them. And it's taken now, let's say, 7 years, and we're just about getting back to where those beds again. It's taken all that time to site them. But anyway, the net result of that, this is the bridge came down, and this is the cause. We can see the end of it. So that's what it looked like. Kind of a long story, and you probably have read about it. But that happened at the same time we had this crescendoing of an opioid epidemic, which is now exploded into a drug epidemic. And then the creation of, it turns out that there were a couple methadone clinics that had to be resited, and they all got resited down in this one area near Mass and Cass. The new city shelter, which is replacing the one on the island, was put down there. The shelter for women, which used to be relatively small, is now 250 beds and right down there. Boston City House, Boston Medical Center is there. Our program is there. And so all the services are concentrated in this area. And what has now happened is that This is Southampton Street just a couple weeks ago, and you can see the tents, and we had never seen anything like this in our city, but the tent city is going in the, I don't know if I've gotten it. You can see it's just a mess. People living on the streets, and trash is everywhere. And as you know, in the current mayoral race, which just ended with Michelle Wu winning, that was a major issue. What is the city going to do about this? And it's a very phony problem. And I wanted to end by saying, I just was looking at my notes the other day, and, you know, right now after COVID, and I could tell you a lot about COVID and homelessness, but after COVID and this, you know, this emergence of a tent city that has seemingly no easy solution, there is a real burnout among the staff of almost everyone working with homelessness, and this feeling like we're working upstream against intractable odds. But look at this. This was Labor Day of 1991. So 30 years ago, this Labor Day, there was this article in the New York Times that I've saved that was a shift in feelings on the homeless where empathy had turned into frustration. And I don't know if you can see the byline. It's Isabel Wilkerson who wrote that. She was a reporter for the New York Times. And Isabel, you know, has written all these wonderful things on racism. But it reminds me, it strikes me as we're in this cycle where, you know, we were so discouraged back in the early 90s. The AIDS epidemic seemed never going to end. People were dying like crazy. Most of the things we had tried with homelessness didn't work. And then we had this time when we were really excited, and now we're back to feeling like, wow, nothing seems to work. But let me leave it there. I do think things work, by the way, but I just wanted to give you a little flavor for where things are. And I'm going to stop sharing if I know how to do this and see if I can see you and have a discussion. Okay, but thank you so much on that. Thank you.
So thank you. So we're open we have a few minutes for questions for Dr. O'Connell, and then we can move to our discussion. Mary Rose.
Dr. O'Connell, I just want to tell you that I'm the person who recruited you. I'm an NGH nurse from 67. So I'm a little older than you, but some of the doctors in the book I actually knew. Carrie Akins was an intern with me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I know. Very strange. And one other thing, just before you came on, I gave a talk about being a nurse. And at the end, I was talking about people who inspire me. And I included Paul Farmer, Yo-Yo Ma. So it's just, I feel very thrilled that we're on the same wavelength. And I saw your story the first time in that movie, The Antidote. Do you remember that? There were 10 stories about people doing things all over the country, and yours was one of them. And then I got the book. But I had been on the Van Bridge Over Troubled Waters years ago. And so I just felt very connected to MGH, of course. Recognize all those pictures, but God bless you and thank you. And I'm just thrilled that you were able to be here. And my one question right now is just, I understand the hope and the lovely relationships you have with so many of these people, but when you go home at night, can you stay uplifted, or is it depressing for you?
Boy, you know, first of all, Mary Rose, thank you for thinking of me, and I'm sure it's because of you that I'm here right now, so thank you. The thought of Carrie Akins as an intern blows my mind, by the way, so okay. That question is really a profound one, because one of the issues over time has been the given job of us was to try to, how do you get young, you know, good, you know, doctors and nurses and respect to choose this as a career, when in fact, when you do the work, it can be utterly discouraging. So it's a hard, and the other problem we had is, how do you get the academic institutions, including the nursing and doctoring and everything else, to support students who want to do that and become that? And I should have mentioned, Mary Rose, just one of the four women that I, you know, it was Barbara McGinnis was really the nurse who, and I hope you know, if you read that book, it's all about nursing. It's a whole tribute to nursing. Everything I do is what I learned from nursing. But the second person was Kip Tiernan, who founded Rosie's Place. And Kip was part of our board. She beat me to death about different things that we had to do and not do. But I love Kip dearly. And then Sister Margaret Leonard, who ran Project Hope, which is a family shelter in Dudley Square, now Nubian Square, was, you know, she was just a fiercely social justice oriented nun who had come from Harlem and was really working. You know, she had the families doing sweat equity, building their own homes. So I learned a ton from her. But the other one was Barbara Blakeney. And Barbara Blakeney was the nurse who was the homeless nurse for the city of Boston, who went on to become the president of the American Nurses Association. And she's a force. And I mean, we were, you know, that and our, you know, I should have mentioned that those people I showed you in the beginning, the Consumer Advisory Board, we have on our board of directors anywhere from 4 to 7 homeless people, you know, one of our 15-member board. You know, we're a relatively big program now, 65 million. I mean, it's not huge, but 65 million. We have 600 employees, and they are our bosses. They tell us what to do. And I think there's something about that that has kept us from going too far astray. Now, that said, we go through it. I've always worked in a team. The homeless people said we got to work in teams. And I realized the brilliance of that was not only continuity, but we can share both the joy and the sadness. And so you don't feel like you're on your own. The way I used to in the hospital, when I lost a patient, it was my problem. Now it's our problem, and it was shared with so many things. So we do lose people who find it impossible. You know, here, let me end by saying this. I'm going home. Turns out we had to come to grips with the fact that as hard as we want to advocate, we are not going to change the homeless problem. You know, we're not going to solve it. It's only going to be solved when society gets together, fixes schools and fixes, you know, so much of the racial and income equity that pushes all this. But we can take really good care of people stuck in that situation. And when you fall into that, then it becomes a real privilege. We're not going to solve the big problem, but we can take care of you now. And we can walk with people in the darkness, put it that way. And I think that's where you sort out. And then it becomes more joyful than not. We get incredibly sad when we lose somebody, as you know, especially people we've known for so long. But in fact, the work itself, the doctoring and the nursing, I think if you talk to anyone on a program, they'd love it. You know, it's just, you feel like you're in a spot where you really. So that's a kind of a wishy-washy way to answer a very direct question, but okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. O'Connell, I wanted to say to you that I found your book a few years ago and read it, and I now understand, as I hear your biography, you've been to theology school too, because as I read this book, I'm thinking, I felt so much compassion from you, humility, generosity, even the stories about meeting Barbara McGinnis and washing feet and not being able to stand behind your doctoring skills, but meeting people, using their first names. And so can you at this point tell how much your theology studies have affected you as a doctor and this calling, or I don't know.
That's a tough one. excuse me. Thank you. I have an assistant here who's just come through. Put it this way. I graduated in the 60s. So I actually didn't get to medical school until I was in my 30s. Right. So Mary Rose, I may not be so far behind you, actually. But there is no doubt. I had Catholic, I had nuns for 8 years in grammar school. I had Christian Brothers for high school. And then I went to Notre Dame. Talk about a total Catholic education. And I came from an Irish Catholic family that was not very much into the clergy, but very much into social justice. So I think there was no, I was trapped. I was a philosophy major in college. And then I wanted to learn about philosophy, religion, because I was fascinated by what motivates people. And I realize that I think that search is part of what defines who you are. So it's always trying to figure out what is this life all about has always been something. And I remember being thrilled to finally in my 30s find medicine. I was a bartender for years. And I keep thinking the best training I've had for the job I have right now was bartending, because, you know, you're behind a bar. People mm-hmm. talk to you. You have to listen. You can't escape. And you have to be patient. So I think those skills that I learned there matched really well with that kind of desire to find something that meant something. I wanted to find some meaning in life. Last reflection I have is how interesting that it came from something I wasn't, came my way. I didn't go looking for it. Like, I knew nothing about homelessness when I took this job. And it was a job that I did because I couldn't say no to my chief of medicine, or I would lose my credibility or something like that. So I did it as a 1-year thing. And then it opened up and I realized this was hitting all the nerves that I had. So yes, I think that 2 years I spent, I was over at Cambridge and did that theology over there. And it was I think it was very much germane to the search that has kind of motivated my life. Without being religious, I don't want to make that sound sanctimonious. Right. That was just where I was coming from.
Yeah, thank you. And I, of course, was so touched by how often you surrendered to smart, intelligent women who knew more than you did, and how willing you were to do that. It's a really important part of your story. So thank you.
So welcome.
So we're opening our discussion now. It's a little past one, and Mary Rose gave us a talk earlier, and Dr. O'Connell's shared so much with us. So if there are comments you have, or ideas that you have, or questions, or ways that you want to talk with each other, it's all open. Susan.
I was struck by how cancer was the principal cause of death. And is that much greater than in the general population?
Yes, it is. Although what I would say is that when you look at the types of cancer it is, to be very honest with you, when you step behind the statistics, it's primarily lung cancer. That's by far the most common. And when you look behind that, these are people that have grown up in real poverty, you know, and deprivation. And almost all of them started smoking when they were 10 or 11 years old. And the other cancers have been liver cancers and head and neck cancers, which are very much related to alcohol intake. So it's this combination of, you know, because they started becoming addicted to these things at a very young age, the cancer shows up 30 years later. So instead of showing up at 65, it's showing up at 45. Or 55. Yeah. So we were struck by that. That's all what I read in that is, oh my God, they've lived in this terrible collision of, you know, and if you think of psychiatric issues, most people with schizophrenia will smoke nonstop. We haven't been able to figure out how to stop that. So it's a combination of the, you know, the medical problem that comes up from a substance use issue and a psychiatric issue. So it's interwoven in a way that, but it is, by the way, now drug overdose is now becoming, in our general population of homeless people, drug overdose has overtaken cancer by a little bit as the most common cause of death, most frequent cause of death. So we're now worried about that as well.
Thank you. Lee had her hand up.
Lee, you're muted.
Early on when you talked about your advisory committee, I think you said they didn't want either students or volunteers, and yet as you were giving your stories, it seemed to me you referred to students and volunteers. How did you overcome that concern on the part of the homeless?
It's a great question. Thank you for bringing that up, because I sort of slipped over it. So what they were worried about was how do we provide continuity of care? And for 5 years, it was just me and another, you know, it was a small team, and we were there every day. We would answer our phones 24 hours a day. We were working nonstop. And once we had that infrastructure in place, then they allowed us to bring in volunteers and do some of those other things. But it was all on the basis that there would be continuity. There would not be, it would not be solely volunteers. So, and now I am so appreciative of that, because we have almost 40 doctors now working with us, and probably 50 nurse practitioners and PAs. And most of them worked with us as students to get a flavor of what it's about, and then took the jobs later on. So having students has been vital to us being able to invite people into doing this as a profession. So great question. I should have made that clear. But the homeless people were thrilled. Once we set up, they were then thrilled to have. In fact, they're honored now to have students. It's really nice. They like to teach them. One of our board members gives the white coat, speaks at the white coat ceremony at Harvard Medical School every year, tells her story. And she feels it's very important in her life to be able to educate new students about what homeless people go through.
That's great to hear. I live in a very small town in Maine. Maybe I'll come to the streets of Boston in order to get continuity of care.
Okay. I hear you. I'm in the same boat.
Yes, Barbara.
Thank you for a wonderful, wonderful talk. I'm remembering some years ago, and I'm not sure how far back, when they closed a lot of the mental hospitals and saying that people deserved to be free and outside. And if you were to ask the people that you see on the street, would they say they preferred the freedom and the sense of community, in spite of the horrors of being on the street, that they prefer that to being back in a mental hospital where they got meals regularly and perhaps some care, but were treated as mental cases. I'm just curious which they would prefer in this transition to hopefully a much better place once society decides to do something better.
That's such an important point, by the way. I don't know if you sort of might have said no volunteers, and one of the things they wouldn't let us do was mental health services in the very beginning. And the reason for that was, just as you point out, the shelter, Pine Street Inn, for example, was convinced it was, in 1985, the largest de facto mental health institution in the state, and they were just a shelter, that everything had been closed down. People ended up going into shelters who really needed mental health care. So that was the reason we couldn't do mental health at first. They thought they wanted to keep the pressure on the Department of Mental Health to come up with better community-based services. And that's it's a very long story behind that deinstitutionalization. But I think what we did is went from essentially 800,000 inpatient psychiatric beds across the country. And with the, you know, civil rights legislation and civil liberties and all of that, it went down in deinstitutionalization to less than 200,000. So we're now at 25% of what we used to have. And in many cases, that was great because those institutions were way underfunded. People were living in, you know, in back wards in their own excrement. It was really terrible for the most part. But then we just closed them and said, well, we can take much better care of them in the community. But they never invested the money in the community services. They just closed the hospitals and then people were out. And that has haunted us ever since. And now when we're on the street and see somebody that we're really worried about, who's clearly thought disordered and you know, and just really delusional, to take that, to bring them in against their will is a real effort, because it may not be something very comfortable on the other end. And is it better to let them be the way they are outside? And that particularly haunts us during the very cold weather when people won't come in, but we know they're in danger of really dying. So we struggle with that literally every day. When is it okay to let people do what they want to do and make their own choices? Or when is it just too dangerous and their thought disorder is not allowing them to make good decisions and we should bring them in? I'll give you one story that haunts me, and that's just to let you know. So we had one woman who was, you know, we're on the van. We're always trying to just make connections to people. We never try to push them. We just want to get them to take sandwiches, get to know us. And this one woman who was often ranted and raved, lived downtown, but she was relatively stable on this thing. And we remember thinking it was a victory when, after a couple of years, she finally acknowledged us and took a sandwich. And we said, that's a victory. But we let her be because she had been there for a long time. And then she had a break one wintertime and yelled at passersby and the police. And she got put in against her will into a psychiatric institution, got put on medications. And that was the last we heard of her. And I went to a meeting several years later at a shelter in the South Shore. And there she was, all dressed and on the board of this shelter. And I looked at her and I just went to say, God, you look fabulous, wonderful. You know, what's going on? And she looked at me and she said, you bastard, you left me outside all those years and did nothing. And then I was like, oh my God. So we don't know. And it's going to, that line is forever going to go back and forth. And we have to make these arbitrary decisions and hope for the best.
Wow. Thank you.
That's quite a story.
It haunts me to this day, let me tell you.
Yeah. Any other things that anyone wants to bring up? Marcia?
Yes, I was going to ask a similar question to Barbara Sweets. I remember when Mattapan San was an active mental health inpatient place. And I was wondering what happened to the places when they closed. Did they turn them into condominiums, or are there still outpatient services, or what?
You know, there's a funny answer to that. If you look around the country, not so much Boston, if you look at the places like in New York City and San Francisco where they've closed the mental health hospitals, and you look at what they are now, they're primarily shelters for homeless people. So it's kind of an interesting evolution of that. In Boston, that has not happened, though, because I think Mattapan San was closed when I started. But I do know that the River Street campus of Mattapan Hospital became a place where they have several recovery programs now. called transitions, and that's in the old psychiatric wing of that. But I don't know what's happened to the rest of them, because most of them were closed, you know, when I was still not even thinking about medicine and wasn't aware of them at all. Most of these closed in the late 60s and early 70s. And then the increase in homelessness happened about 5 to 10 years after that. So people sort of held on for a while. They were in rooming houses and stuff like that. When the rooming houses closed, those people who had been in hospitals ended up back on the streets.
It sounds like the New Hampshire motto, live free or die.
It absolutely does. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Thank you. Your speech was very inspiring to me, and your whole life and your whole career. And I'm really glad you studied theology. Our group used to meet at Harvard Divinity School, and we used to be called the Theological Opportunities Program. So we used to study more theology back in the 70s.
So I can feel at home here then. Okay. Good.
Yeah. Just wanted to tell you that.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
You're so welcome.
I think, Paula, did you have your hand up? You're muted.
Yep. Okay. First of all, thank you so much for your inspiring talk and your willingness to tell us many, many aspects of your work. And I have to say, early on in your talk, I asked myself, how can he do this? And I gradually just kept seeing your team, and I appreciate your answering the question about, you know, but your team, that is the secret. And it was just very inspiring to me how you can achieve also continuity of care if you have a team. And so that's one thing. And the other thing I wanted to ask you is, why did they close? I don't understand why they closed Long Island. I mean, the problem that happened by closing Long Island seems worse than building a new bridge. So what happened that they vacated that seemingly decent solution?
I'm tempted to say, don't get me started, you know? So what I remember clearly is in July of 1985, driving to go work on Long Island. It's a beautiful drive, by the way. But I remember I had to stop at the bridge because it was being fixed and it could only be one lane. And then you have to let one lane come from one side, one lane. So it was in being repaired back in 1985. And then over the years, there was a nonstop series of repairs. And I kept saying a long time ago, why don't they just fix the bridge rather than just keep repairing it? Because I'm sure they spent way more than the cost of a new bridge by repairing it. And I think it was, you know, there was just a failure. I think the island was always just seen as it was there and nobody really put the funding into it that needed to be in there. I don't think anyone realized how valuable it was from that thing. So I think it was a lack of vision, to be very honest with you. And when the bridge finally came down, and this is a one critical thing I would say, although I don't want to, you know, be too critical, but we knew the bridge was in disrepair and might be impassable for a couple of years before it happened. So we were wondering, why isn't the city or someone preparing for that? You know, either let's fix the bridge or let's get someplace, alternative places. Because when the bridge was declared impassable on that night, October 8th, we had 3 hours to get everybody off the bridge and there was no place to bring them, no plan. So they all came down to Boston City Hall, Boston Medical Center. We used our building. We had 45 women sleeping in our building, which is down at Mass and Cass. And the gymnasium at Boston Medical Center became 250 cots for men. And this was October, just before wintertime. And it was like that for a whole year before the new shelter. So there was a real distinct lack of preparing. And, you know, I've loved the city and working in Boston. You know, it's been incredibly gratifying because so many people are so good and caring about that, including the city. But in this particular setting, there was no one seemed to really plan ahead. And it was shocking to me that there was no plan.
Thank you.
Barbara.
Is there some kind of national network of people who do what you do, who compare notes and sort of know what's going on in other cities? Because this problem is growing. And I guess my other question I have, a study's been done in terms of in recent times, is the percentage of homeless, is it pretty steady throughout the nation, or does it change?
You know, a series of really important questions. So there is, for the first part, there is a network now. We're funded, our Healthcare for the Homeless program here in Boston is one of about 350 around the country funded by the federal government. They all look very different depending on their settings, but we have a whole network of colleagues, and there is a meeting every year, one meeting a year, when we actually get a chance to get together and share experiences with people. I forgot the second part of the question. I'm so sorry, Barbara. What was the second part of the question?
So my question is, in the last two decades, as an example, has the percentage of homeless in cities across the nation stayed the same? I know, in which case, the numbers have gone up because our population has gone up, or has the percentage, in fact, increased?
Everything has increased, so the number and the percentage. And it's been sort of a slow, steady incline like that. Yeah, what is tricky is that we don't have good national data. The way they get the data is on one night every year, usually in January, sponsored by HUD. They go out and count who you can count, and that's the number that gets reported. But it turns out, you know, if you did that in Boston, you know, which we do. If you saw, 8,000 people on Thursday night in January, if you did that again in March, you'd see another 8,000 people, but it wouldn't always be the same people, you know, so the total number is hard to get. But when they do that one night count, they have seen that number for a short time from 2009 to 2014, it looked like it was going down slowly. And for the last 4 years, it's just gone up. So, and now what I think, if there's to share a perspective with you, it turns out that about 80% of all the homeless adults in this country are in the major metropolitan areas. So if you look at, for example, LA, I spent a lot of time at Skid Row in LA. LA County has 60,000 homeless people on the streets. Okay, think of that, 60,000. In all of New England, we have a total of 20,000 homeless people, shelters and everything. So LA is off the wall. New York is not far behind. And then you have San Francisco, Portland. And if you take those major metropolitan areas, that's 80% of all the homeless people. So we have from a numbers point of view, we have a huge urban problem with homelessness. That doesn't mean that there isn't, you know, rural homelessness, but it's the numbers are dwarfed by the urban stuff. And if you go to San Francisco, that when I showed you those things of the tent city here in Boston, if you go to LA or San Francisco or Portland or San Francisco or Seattle now, the tent cities are almost make the cities unlivable. And it's a big struggle right now to try to figure out what to do about that. So that's the increasing number that everybody's worried about. There's been a lot of money put into veterans homelessness. So the numbers of veterans who are homeless have gone down with a lot of support from that's the one place where Congress is giving money to homelessness. It goes to veterans homelessness really, and they've done a great job with that, but it hasn't filtered to the rest of us yet.
Just taking people who haven't spoken yet. I see Penny has your hand up, and then Linda, and then we'll need to do our announcements.
I was struck with your opening about how they really set some very stern directions for how you could interact with them when you came into their facility and came in to help with them. So it says, but I guess those were the professionals who had gotten that information from the homeless. What I'm trying to find is there some sense of community amongst them that can be built upon so that they become more empowered to structure a kind of community where there's safety, understanding, no stigma, and some sense of responsibility and care for one another that allows them to be a community, even with some of their for want of a better term, and I'm not happy to use it, but I'm wordless, but for their unique idiosyncrasies. And I wondered if the shelter on the island showed any indicator that when they were living out on the island, was there something that may have emerged, or that possibility to look at how to empower them as a community that seemed to have a certain idea of identity and what they will or won't accept from, maybe I'm being too wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, but I've just wondered if there's any observation of some form of their own community.
Really intriguing question, but there is a, you know, the best writing in homelessness is usually done by the anthropology community. And there is a raging debate within anthropology about whether there is really a homeless community or not. I think if you hang out and watch homeless people, there is a strong community. Like when we have our clinic on Thursdays, which, you know, is we can see anywhere from, you know, 70 to 150 homeless people in our clinic, street people. If we're not going to be there tomorrow, we just tell one person and no one shows up. So there is a real network. Now, what I worry about a little bit is that, and the other thing I would say, so for our program, for example, those rules were set by homeless people who insisted on that. The mayor was horrified. He didn't really want to do all that. If I had been there, I would have been horrified. I would have said, we need students, we need volunteers, but they wouldn't do it. That was them. And that group of people, they have been on our board. We have a consumer advisory board, which is probably 20 people that meets every month and has been for 30 years. And from that group, there's always 5 to 7. And I say that 5 to 7 because we have so many deaths that it changes, then we have to get somebody else on there. But they are very much involved in the governance of the program and in any programmatic stuff they are involved in. So in that sense, they have been really involved. The problem, of course, is that, you know, they are still on the streets or still struggling to be, you know, make it in a shelter. And what we have to support everything to get them to meetings. In fact, the meetings, just to show you, to get our folks to a meeting, we pay them $20 for each meeting. We have a meal at the meeting and we provide all the transportation because they don't have anything. And to get them involved in any kind of consistent way, you really have to support it. And we learned this, if I could give you an example, we learned this with COVID. You know, when they say we have to isolate people, if you have no money and you say, go stay at home or go stay somewhere, you can't do it. So you have to be sure somebody's bringing you all the stuff. So I think the barrier to having a really good homeless community is we haven't provided the support for them to be communities. And on the island, to finance this, the island, remember, people had to leave during the day, come back at night. So you didn't really have a time to foment the community. However, they made a farm out there, a homeless farm on the island, which provided all the green produce for the shelters. And that's where people really got bonded together and became a real community. The homeless people ran that farm. It was fabulous. So I know the potential is there. We just haven't been creative enough in our ways of offering that to them.
If I could respond, just Jim, one thing. I live in Rockport, Maine, and in Rockport or Rockland, there are adjacent towns. There's something called the Hospitality House, which has been a new way of helping the homeless, at least in mid-coast Maine. It's homeless women and their children. They have a house. I think it houses about 25 to 30 residents, but they live together, and the women learn from each other and help each other in their living there. And when they first opened the house, they then began to make out of the barn and back offices. So they didn't have to go from here to there to there to there to get the various services. The services were built in the barn, in the back of the house. There's a playground for the children. They also made sure to have the children get bused to the school they were from, not to a new school, so they had that stability rather than the shakeup. And it's been a pretty successful program. And they actually, those who have left Hospitality House to find their housing, in their housing, there's a picnic every summer where they come back. And it's kind of like an alumni gathering. So that in my impression is that it's been pretty successful in modeling. We bring the services to them and help them build a community and support one another. And they do have a network amongst themselves, even after they have gone on to find their home and job and education. So I just offer that up as a location in the Mid-Coast Coalition for Homelessness.
That's music to my ears, Penny. I'm going to look into that because that's exactly what I mean. If you provide the right setting, you'll find that communities spring up.
It is in Rockport or Rockland, Maine. It's the Mid-Coast Coalition for Homelessness. And I can, if you have a problem with that, I'll look for the more formal name. But the Homeless Coalition in Mid-Coast, Maine, and it's called the Hospitality House is the actual housing. It is for women and children, and they do use other hotel rooms in the area for men.
No, I will find it. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So we're out of time. Thank you so much, Dr. O'Connell. We really appreciate you coming and sharing all this with you and teaching us. I think we didn't know enough about what was happening on Long Island either. Perhaps we could have, as citizens, been more helpful in saving it if we had any idea. So
thank you all. It's such a pleasure. I will leave you now, and I appreciate it. Okay, have a good day.
Thank you. Yes. Bye-bye.
Thank you.